going to start our discussions with Lisis. Katrina.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Hans, and good afternoon. And this, we will be discussing Lisis for what we plan to be the last time before we publish the final standard. And we've got two sort of broad areas to discuss today. First of all, a number of sweep issues that have arisen out of the drafting process, which we'll discuss first. That means that we'll discuss Agenda Paper 3A, then 3C, and then the other topic will be the effective date. So we'll come back and discuss the effective date, which is Agenda Paper 3B again. So with that, I'll hand over to Sarah.
So I'll be teeing up Agenda Paper 3A, which discusses four sweep issues that have arisen as a result of comments received on the external review draft. I'm going to tee up each issue separately. So issue one in the paper discusses whether lease modifications that extend the term of the lease should be treated as a new lease or as the continuation of an existing lease. The external review draft stated that these modifications be treated as a new lease if they were priced commensurately. This issue is one of timing. The difference between the two alternatives is whether the assets and liabilities associated with the extension of the lease are recognized at the date the modification is agreed, or at the commencement of the extension period, which could be months or years after the date the modification is agreed. The staff recommend that a lease modification that extends the term of the lease is treated as a continuation of the existing lease. The staff thinks that because the lessee already controls the use of the underlying asset at the date of the modification, such a modification that amends rights and obligations that the lessee already has should be recognized immediately. The staff note that this treatment would be consistent with the general treatment of extension options and also consistent with the recent decision made by the FASB in this area. So with that, I'll hand it over to the board.
If you increase the scope of the lease, mm-hmm. you would treat the whole arrangement as a new lease or just the increased scope?
So if you increase the scope of the lease, there's two ways that you could do it. You could extend the term of the original underlying asset, or you could add new underlying assets. If you add new underlying assets and that's priced commensurately, you would treat that as a new lease. But an extension of an existing underlying asset would be treated as a continuation.
So you would actually kind of bifurcate the new deal, you know, then the the original lease that gets extended, that would be
the continuation.
Continuation, that would be as the date the terms are agreed to.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the new scope would be whenever they sort of commence.
Whenever those new underlying assets are delivered.
Because my concern was, and you're clarifying it, is what if you put the tiniest of scope increase in it, you know, with one room on a 20-story building or something, you know, you wouldn't want to have a workaround built in, and so if you're comfortable, that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, so basically we say if there is that additional, so the one we're not talking about today, which is an increase in scope where, say, you add a new underlying asset, what in fact happens there is, assuming it's priced commensurately, it's just the additional piece that you treat as a new lease, and the original lease would continue to run unchanged.
Yeah. Original lease or the extended lease in this case, but the key thing is the date the terms are agreed to.
Yep.
I think the suggestion makes sense. I think it follows from the logic of the structure of the document in terms of our thinking. So my understanding is we're going to have an example which sort of describes how these mechanics would work, right? So I think that will be helpful for people for the point that Gary just raised.
Okay.
Want to press? Should we take a vote on that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
All in favour?
All agree.
Okay. So issue two in the paper discusses whether to update the discount rate for floating interest rate leases when the lease payments are updated for changes in the floating rate. An example of a floating interest rate lease is one where payments are linked to LIBOR. The external review draft stated that the discount rate should not be updated, which is inconsistent with the requirements in IFRS 9 for floating rate financial liabilities measured in amortized cost. The staff recommend that a lessee should update the discount rate for floating interest rate leases whenever the lease payments are updated because of a change in the interest rate used to determine those payments. The staff think that such an adjustment should be treated as a change in interest expense because the change generally relates to the amount of interest the lessee will pay in future periods. And with that, I will hand it back over to the board.
Philippe, could you explain to us what is the rationale that FASB has followed in deciding not to do what we're proposing here? Because that would create a divergence if we accept the proposal. So I'd like to understand better what's the reason why FASB decided not to do it.
So this is actually a moot point for the FASB because while we require a lessee to update the lease payments, when lease payments are based on an index or a rate, the FASB has decided not to require a lessee to update its lease payments.
So actually the outcome of this would actually probably mean an outcome that is closer to their decision, because for these floating rate leases at least we'd be updating the cash flows and updating the discount rate, which would probably get us closer.
So the carrying amount would be more similar to the FASB's carrying amount.
Mm-hmm.
And just a concern about whether this updating of the discount rate when you have a myriad of leases is not a bit onerous. Do you have an assessment of what it does as an impact?
I think that's just to clarify then why I think our recommendation is strictly into what we call, we've called it here floating interest rate leases or benchmark leases or whatever, as opposed to kind of the broader category that might be, say, linked to CPI or beyond. And the thing that for me, Philippe, I suppose, at least made me think, you know, on our recommendation is actually some of the external reviewers that commented on this, they actually, in the comments they gave, they thought this would be less onerous for lessees in a sense, rather than in these, you know, in these scenarios where you have got a lease that is truly like a floating rate lease saving to LIBOR, if we were actually making the lessees update the cash flows but not the discount rate, at least these external reviewers thought that would be more onerous than not updating the discount.
And the important point here is that we're already requiring them to remeasure the liability.
Exactly.
This is simply the tool that they use in conducting the exercise they already conducted. And the only way they can remeasure the liability is presumably to know what the rate is that would apply to them.
Exactly.
Yeah, but they could have remeasured based on the new amount of payments without changing the discount rate that was originally put into the system they could have used. So it's a combination of both determining the new payments, which I think is logical, and I don't see how we could avoid that, but also putting a new discount rate on a lease-by-lease basis, because you have to go through which discount rate you use when you do that. How do you determine the new discount rate? The one you had originally was probably implicit or explicit in the lease contract.
Mm-hmm.
Then the remeasurement, the new discount rate, will have to be determined on what basis. You don't have information on the lease contract. You have to determine on another basis, and what will be that basis?
I think, look, my understanding of practice, by the way, is that, first of all, that these types of leases are not necessarily very frequent in a sense, but when they do exist, they are mostly sitting in leases that are effectively our finance leases today, or at least if not finance leases, are priced exactly as financing transactions. So they're sitting in leases that are being priced, you know, very similarly to how a variable rate loan is being priced. So I anticipate, based on our understanding of practice, that it would be a scenario where, yes, you would know the rate initially, and I presume you'd also know the rate when it gets adjusted.
Are we going to provide any guidance on how to do it in practice, or example, or no?
So,
I agree with this, and I think that basically what people have told us is that unless we allow them to do this, they're going to have an internally inconsistent measurement, because we're requiring them to update the floating payments when they change, so we're not asking people to predict, but as they change in the sort of simplified way that we did, and they've said to us, well, it's not consistent to then require us to keep in a locked-in discount rate, and also it's going to cause them to have volatility in the carrying amount of their liability and their right-of-use asset when economically there's been no change in value. So they've sort of flagged to us that this is a counterintuitive way to require them to do it, and it's going to cause volatility that's not real volatility, so it's a request. And I would have thought that typically where this happens, the rate that they would use to update the payments would be the same as the rate they're going to use to do the discounting. So it's not requiring them to get an extra piece of information, as I understand it. But it's come as a request. It's not something we've made up ourselves.
Yeah.
It's a concern raised by respondents.
That's right, and particularly those they were very much sort of commenting on it that they would view this as actually being easier to do and providing more sensible outcomes for lessees, you know, as opposed to kind of just saying, oh, it's inconsistent with another piece of the requirements. It was very much linked to sort of ease for lessees in a sense.
Just to reinforce Patrina's assessment and Sue's argument there. Coming from a country where there is a significant amount of floating rate contracts in general in the financial system, and particularly in the leasing, they do actually would process gap dating in the system altogether, cash flows and the rates. So this, I think, will be aligned with the current practice in countries where floating rate contracts are common. So yes, I do agree with you and Sue.
All in favour?
Okay. Issue 3 in the paper discusses whether obligations to return an asset to the lessor in a specified condition at the end of a lease, to dismantle or remove an underlying asset, or to restore the site on which the underlying asset had been located, should be treated as lease payments or should be treated as separate provisions in accordance with IAS 37. The staff recommend that such restoration obligations be treated as provisions in accordance with IAS 37 and also be treated as part of the cost of the right of use asset. Any changes in the obligation should be treated as an adjustment to the cost of the right of use asset. The staff think it is appropriate to be consistent with the requirements for similar costs associated with owned assets in IAS 16, IAS 37, and IFRIC 1. So with that, I will hand it back to the board. So the last issue, issue 4, discusses whether an acquirer and a business combination should recognize an asset or liability for any favorable or unfavorable terms relating to acquired short-term leases or leases of low-value assets in which it is the lessee, similar to the requirements that currently exist for operating leases in IFRS 3. The staff does not recommend that an acquirer should be required to recognize assets or liabilities for acquired short-term leases or leases of low-value assets in which it is the lessee. The board has already decided that the cost of capitalizing such leases outweigh the benefits. We believe that the same rationale would also apply to the requirements of IFRS 3. So with that, I will hand it back to the board.
Agree. Quick observation. I can accept this. This isn't my preferable treatment, and the reason is because in the context of business combinations, we typically have exceptions to the treatment of the way something is measured. So you may have IP R&D, it's expense, but in the context of a business combination, when you buy it, you capitalize it, as an example. So in this particular case, I think if you were valuing a company and you had material amount of this kind of thing, it might be just as easy, frankly, to capitalize it. Now, it could then end up being buried in goodwill, but at the end of the day, I think it's more consistent with the business combination literature and it would be more appropriate, but it's an exception to an exception, I guess. So I can live with it, but
really? Just with similar concern, let's assume that you have a short-term lease which has not been capitalized, but you have very, very unfavorable terms for the next 12 months. You have a big out-of-market price, even if it is for 12 months. Would that not warrant having a recognition on the business combination? By exception to this exception, I mean, okay for not doing in general, but you have real one-off situation where it's very material, but off-market condition. Could not we say except when very material, or except when material?
Yeah, and I suppose, by the way, the only I think it could be fully, but obviously depending on you know the risks, you know what I think the risks are. I suppose we had just thought that overall, particularly saying that in terms of short term, that We'd even concluded that generally recognizing the whole assets and liabilities is not something we require in the standard. So even then, if you think about when the terms and conditions might be favourable or unfavourable in the context of that, you're only talking about then, you know, this sort of netting in a sense. That, and
agree, but
for us, we just thought that that potentially would be.
I contrast this with the situation if you had a contract with a customer which is onerous. Could be a 12-month contract. It's an onerous contract. We would require in the business combinations to accrue for that and onerous situation. If the lease, 12 months, same amount, same effect, is onerous, we'd say no, because we have a blanket exception, you don't recognize. So in contrast, I'm not sure it really makes sense to have a difference in treatment.
But the problem surely is then you're forcing companies to trawl through every short-term lease and low-value lease to see if something is very material, although I'm not sure what very material is.
Yeah, I agree that we should not make it a systematic thing, but either have knowledge of a very material unfavorable situation, hopefully they should know it through their due diligence.
Then it's kind of an option.
I mean, the acquirer should be aware of the situation, I hope. It's not a bad surprise.
I mean, the better approach is just to say, yes, recognize onerous leases if material, and just rely on materiality. But then the problem is people are going to have to trawl through every lease and do all the calculations. So this, to me, is a practical way of giving cost relief, and it's unlikely to be material in most cases, and presumably it would be flagged through disclosure if it really wasn't material.
Okay, can we agree with the staff recommendation?
All in favour?
Okay, then we go to 3C.
Okay, agenda paper 3C then discusses another sweep issue. This one relates to leases that are within the scope of IFRS 5. So IFRS 5 states that the disclosure requirements in other standards do not apply to items within its scope unless that is explicitly required by those other standards. That means that based on the current decisions, the disclosure requirements in the new leases standard will not apply to leases that are within the scope of IFRS 5. A number of you raised some questions about this on reviewing a draft of the new standard, so we thought it was worth asking for your views. We're recommending that the IASB retain the approach as it is, i.e. that the disclosure requirements in the new leases standard should not apply to those leases that are within the scope of IFRS 5. That's because we think that the disclosure requirements in IFRS 5 are sufficient for those leases. By definition, any lease that falls within the scope of 5 is expected to be disposed of within 12 months, whilst the disclosure requirements in IFRS 16 were developed with leases in mind that are expected to be held throughout the lease term. So for that reason, we think that the more relevant information is given by the disclosure requirements in IFRS 5 for those leases. So with that, I'll hand over for discussion.
No discussion? Sue?
I think I'm okay with it, but I just wanted to just sort of observe one thing. Because IFRS 5 is mainly focused on the sort of asset side of the equation, even though it does talk about, I can't remember, units that are being held for sale, but it's mainly focused on assets and disclosures about assets. So taking this approach, we would get a different outcome to if I had a scenario where I had a subsidiary that I was holding to sell with liabilities in it, wouldn't I? Because wouldn't the IFRS 7 disclosures on maturity, etc., for the liabilities still apply for that subsidiary, whereas here we would lose the stuff on the obligations on the liability side? So that's the only difference I see. I'm not sure that it worries me that much, but just to sort of flag it.
A couple of things on that. I mean, the only way leases really will get into this is if they are part of sort of a
subsidiary that's got a lease or something.
So, and in that case, in terms of the liability, similar to what we're proposing for the leases standard, there aren't any specific requirements in, say,
IFRS 7 about this, but IFRS 5 itself does give some guidance where you are using the measurement requirements of other standards rather than this one, any relevant disclosures have to apply. So that is in IFRS 5 itself, and it wouldn't be affected by what we're suggesting here. I'm not sure if that actually answers the question.
I thought you'd still have to provide the liability information for normal liabilities. But maybe I'm making that up.
Sorry, look at 5B.
5B.
Hans, while she looks at 5B, yeah. I'll just say that as one of the people who'd raised the question, I wanted to thank the staff for bringing this paper, even though it was late, and I think it was short enough to digest at the late moment, because I think it's important that it's an explicit consideration of whether we want to do it, and I thought the staff's analysis in the paper was good in terms of what would be useful information for, you know, investors and the sellers' financial statements, so I thought it worked well.
You're right, it does apply to disposal groups, so...
Can we support the staff's recommendation?
All in favour.
Okay, that leaves us with the effective date.
Okay, the final leases paper then is agenda paper 3B, which discusses effective date. So we've performed some outreach on this topic with both preparers and with users, which broadly covered three things. Firstly, how long stakeholders think they'd need to implement the new leases standard, particularly in light of the transition reliefs that were decided upon back in February. Secondly, we sought their views on the possibility of the new leases standard having the same effective date as IFRS 9 and IFRS 15, which is 1st of January 2018. And finally, we talked to stakeholders about whether they thought early applications should be permitted. And so preparers and users had quite different views. Users quite strongly support an effective date of January 2018, which would be approximately 2 years after publication. And that's because they'd like to see the new standard implemented as soon as possible, and because for them it's beneficial if a few changes are introduced together rather than being spread over a number of years. Preparers, however, think that 3 years is needed to implement the standard, and that would mean an effective date of January 2019. Some of them base that view on the fact that they would need to use similar resources to implement both leases and revenue, and they didn't think that it was feasible to implement both of them on the same date. Many, however, thought that 3 years would be needed in any event because of the amount of work that will be involved in implementing the leases standard. So in light of all the feedback we've had, we are recommending an effective date of January 2019. We think that a mandatory effective date that's earlier than that would not be achievable for all preparers. We are, however, also recommending that early application be permitted, and that would enable any entity that does want to apply leases at the same time as IFRS 9 and IFRS 15 to do that. And it would also benefit any entity that adopted IFRS for the first time between publication and the effective date of the leases standard. Finally, we're recommending that the new leases standard should specifically prohibit an entity from applying it before it applies IFRS 15. And that's because some of the interactions between the new leases standard and revenue wouldn't really work if an entity wasn't applying IFRS 15. So with that, I will hand over for discussion.
We received a letter from Deutsche Telekom last week, mm-hmm. and in that letter they're proposing another alternative, which I think combines what you have also in this paper, which is really kind of allow early application, and that entities can really implement the standard together with especially IFRS 15, because they have, if they are lesser, and sell the product, they have, I think, some opportunities to bring it together. But on the other hand, I think it is also for some preparers which are also heavily lazy,
difficult to implement it in the years from when we finalized the standard until 2018. So they proposing that maybe we can split it. We can say, okay, it should be also allowed, maybe that we can have early application only for the leather component of the standard, but then not doing the lazy requirements of that standard. And has the staff thought about that, and what are the pros and cons about of this proposal?
We have considered it, and as you will have seen from the paper, it's not something that we're suggesting. The short version of the reason for that is that we don't believe there's enough benefit in that approach to justify adding complexity to the standard. And to give a bit more detail on that, there's a few things to say. I think firstly, you know, lessor accounting is substantially unchanged compared to IAS 17, and therefore when thinking through what the, you know, practical benefits of allowing this will be, we think they are limited to what has been identified by the party that sent the letter, which relates to the definition of a lease. They would like to be able to go through the consideration for their contracts of lease versus service at the same time they're going through their IFRS 15 considerations. But thinking about how that would work, we do think that it is quite feasible for those considerations to be done during the process of implementing IFRS 15, and it wouldn't be a problem for leases to then be actually implemented the year after. You know, it doesn't stop those considerations from happening. So we don't think there are significant benefits to this based on the discussions we've had. But I would add that because we are recommending that early adoption be permitted, you know, if there was a circumstance where it was of significant benefit, that option is there, albeit that lessee would have to be adopted as well. In terms of what it would mean for the standard if we went down this approach, we don't think it's quite as straightforward as just saying lessor accounting could be adopted before lessee. And the main reason for that relates to subleases. So we have quite particular guidance relating to subleases because the interaction of lessee and lessor matters quite a lot there. So we would have to introduce some guidance to cover this scenario if we went down this route. And the final thing to say is just to confirm that we have only received this suggestion from the one preparer, and we have done quite a bit of outreach. So it's not something that we've heard sort of pervasively or even multiple times. So putting all of that together, we just don't think the benefits are enough to justify complicating things.
So one of the reasons is really that you think we have to do more work on the standards and really on subleases, and it's not an easy going then. We have to oversee, do we have to...
We would have to sort of make sure we've looked at all the areas that it potentially affects, of which subleases is the best example. It is, of course, doable, but it would complicate the standard and the sort of transition effective date stuff a bit, and we just don't feel the benefits are enough.
Okay, so...
Thank you. Paragraph 39B talks about the first-time application, and the early application is permitted. I agree with you. But the analysis you made in the bottom in this paragraph, the staff thinks that it will be easier and less costly for these entities to apply the new lease standard from the date that they first adopt IFRS as a whole. Mm-hmm. So it may be right. Many first-time applier would apply IFRS 16 rather than IS 17. But unfortunately, IFRS 16 do not give the transition relief to the first-time adopters. And that is reasonable because we don't know what is the legacy standard is all about. We discussed it. Mm-hmm. However, as you said, as you analyzed, you know, because we removed the transition, we gave the transition relief, then the burden wouldn't be hard. But on the other hand, a first-time applier need to do these things. So therefore, my guess is there might be many first-time adopter who goes to IS 17 first, and then move to the IFRS 16. That's what I would I would, you know, prospect it. But anyway, so in that case, maybe if the effective date is too early, it would be very difficult for first-time appliers. But maybe 1/1/19 would be enough. So therefore, I don't disagree with the current proposal. But one other thing I'm a bit concern is we actually deferred effective date of IFRS 15 because of issuance of some clarification. And we need to avoid such things happen again. So therefore, once we decided this is the effective date, 1/1/19 is the effective date, we should keep it anyway. So
that's what we have to commit.
Yeah.
Up to now, there's no intention to establish.
No indication, you know.
Okay. Are we in agreement with the staff's recommendations?
All three of them.
All in favor?
Okay. Well, I suppose we will not take a break.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So that's well done to the leasers table.
Yeah.